accession number 22077, rail 4.
Harold Morris Metcalf, rail 4. So we were talking about Singapore, and you were just going to tell me about the officer's mess. That must have been quite a place, wasn't it? So what was the officer's mess like?
On Wednesday of each week, the band played at the officer's mess. It was about 3/4 miles from our barrack area, the other end of the area. I was soon learning to play my instrument, my bass, but I went on all band engagements to learn and to turn over music for the band sergeant, yes?
What sort of a building was the officer's mess?
Oh, it's pretty wonderful, actually. How can I explain it? It was on stilts, two floors. And quite often we've seen an officer thrown over from the top, by the way, you know, when they were having hijinks, as they used to very often. It was stopped after a while because a couple of them got badly injured. It was a very nice mess. We didn't see much of the inside of it. We played outside in the on the area underneath the mess. We used to see what went on quite a lot, though.
What did go on then?
Well, as I said, they used to muck about in snooker. And I've seen a couple of young second lieutenants thrown over the veranda, broke their arms. Happy days they were.
Yeah. Was there a lot of drinking then?
Pardon?
Was there a lot of drinking there?
Yes, there was a lot of drinking. Singapore slings, they called them. I think there was gin and something else. But they did drink a lot. All of us drank a lot there, by the way. I wasn't a drinking man, but, I mean, we drank all sorts of things.
What did you think about the officer's antics? It's all a bit frivolous,
wasn't it? Can I put it this way? I don't think the general run the regiment ran didn't know. They knew very little about this sort of thing, but the band always knew. They were always, it was band and drums and officers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The band were quite a separate entity, really. They were called the gentlemen of the regiment, just because they always had a bit more money than everyone else, I think. But they were usually quite a well-educated bunch of fellas, bandsmen. I remember on one occasion we went there, and the OC, Colonel Chapman, Mad Chapman as he was called, because he used to take his horse up to the steps into his room, into his order room, and say, "This is where I sit, and that's where Tab sits." And he used to show the horse where they sat, you know. Then he'd come out, and we were all standing outside. The band always had to pray for the colonel before we finished churches. And he'd come up and he'd look at me and he'd say, "How long have you had that suit, boy?" And if he could, he'd rip the epaulette off, you know. He'd say, "Go and get another one tomorrow and tell them I did it." So we had two suits, you understand me, instead of having to buy one. He was a jolly good chap, but crazy. And one evening at the mess, Colonel Chapman, he asked the bandmaster if that boy, that was me, could sing "Goodbye" from the White Horse Inn, which I did. And at every officer's mess after that, till Colonel Chapman left. So you know that I knew it, they knew it, and they used to whistle it all the time. More on that later. One wonderful thing happened to me while I was in Singapore, really wonderful. You know, I was a Salvationist, and there were 10 other of us. One day, the Part 1 order stated, on such and such a day, I forget what it was, at 18:30 hours, the following Salvationists will attend a service at the school. The names were given out, and at the end of the order, it stated, number 5180211, Boy Metcalf, will attend at 1800 hours to arrange the seating. I went down early. A lady in a Salvation Army white uniform came into the room. She looked at me, she walked to the piano, and she said, "Do you know this hymn?" And she played a hymn called "Sweet Rose of Sharon," and I sang it at the same time. She got up from the piano and she hugged me, and she said, "You are Harold Metcalf, aren't you?" And it was my school teacher from my school days in Ashtongate. But the point about it is this: she was a Miss Stone, my junior school teacher. And I remembered, she suddenly left school, very suddenly at one time. And there were all sorts of stories about it, you know. She was up the spout and all that, you know what things were like in those days. And she asked me what they had said when she left. I was a bit embarrassed, but I told her that what they'd said, and she laughed about it. And she said, "No, that's not true. You know, my parents were dogmatic Christian Church of England folk, and I told them I wanted to be a Salvation Army officer, and they threw me out. Said, not very Christian, but that was it. I went straight to training college, where I became an officer, and I'm going to China now." We had a lovely evening. I always remember when the chaps came in, she was hugging me, and they said, "He's at it again, you know." But we had a lovely evening together. My mother was quite tickled when I wrote and told her about it.
Yeah. So she went off to China,
isn't yes,
she?
I never saw her again, ever. Never heard anything more about her. Dear Miss Stone, she was a lovely person. Where was I then?
So, I mean, life went on in Singapore. How long were you there altogether?
Nearly 2 years. The thing was that, I've got that on the next page, actually. I often sang with the regiment band at Raffles Hotel. I went there when I went back on my holiday, just to see the old place. It was a wonderful time, but the time came to leave Singapore. And as far as I remember, there was a petition sent to the War Office from the people in Singapore, including the bishop, asking if the regiment could stay for a further tour. And it was approved, but the Wiltshire Regiment were already on their way down from Shanghai to relieve us, so we didn't stay. It was very unfortunate.
You must have been very sad to leave.
Oh, we didn't want to go. It was the most wonderful station, really. It wasn't the most wonderful one I went to all my life, but at that time it was out of this world, believe me. And we had a wonderful farewell service at Singapore Cathedral, and lovely, lots of things, wonderful things said about the regiment. They really were sad when we left.
How did you leave Singapore?
Can I just go back on that? I've forgotten this one. I had a septic leg. It was quite... In fact, I when I came out of Burma, I had one so big, you could see the hole right through to my bone. That was enough. But that's how things used to get. If you had one of these septic sores, it used to get very bad. And I was in hospital. And I was a bit... It was a bit strange to me that there were no bugs in the beds. And I spoke to the matron about this, and she sort of laughed and didn't say anything. And she came back the next day and she said, "You don't have paint on your barrack room beds, do you?" And I said, "No, ma'am." And they had white lead paint on all the hospital beds, yes? Never had any bugs. So when I got out and told my corporal, who was a battalion, not a quartermaster, but he looked after the stores, he told the colonel, and we were issued with white lead paint, and all the boys painted their beds, and we never had any more bugs. It's a funny old world, isn't it, really? Because then, of course, the whole regiment had to do them. I do remember it, because it was one of those things. Yeah. Everybody had their only in patch.
How was people's health generally in Singapore?
Pardon?
How was people's, the soldiers' health
generally?
Wonderful.
It was actually the concert that they put on to send the planters home that really made... They were wonderful. They really were wonderful folk. I didn't go out very often in Singapore except to go to the musical society. John and I, my chum John, he was a butterfly man, and we used to go catching butterflies. Quite big butterflies. In fact, he had them all in his house when I used to go and see him up when I left the army. That was... Sorry. I told her about that. I told you about the bugs in the bed.
Yeah.
And then we should have gone and we had to go. We couldn't stay. I suppose for me, it was the best time I had all my life, really, in Singapore.
And you were only what?
16, nearly 17 then.
So, one question I've asked you a bit about before, but I mean, did you ever get propositioned by any men in the army or anything when you were...
No, I didn't. I would never was propositioned, and I'll tell you why. I was going to say it later on, but if I tell you now. I loved sport, and in fact, I put it down here somewhere, but I won't tell you about that now. But I ought to, because it made a lot of difference to me. I was a boxer, and although I was a boy, I wasn't allowed to scrap in the regiment at the time. But I became a battalion middleweight, and because I was a boxer and I used to do a lot of sport, and I was a Salvationist, I was never approached. I suppose, as I told you, there were two of the boys definitely queers, and quite a lot of men in the regiment. They were all in the concert party. But I was never approached with regard to that, except on one occasion. We had a boy, Leonard Livingstone, with whom I enlisted, actually, and I shouldn't really say this, I suppose, we were not allowed to smoke, boys. We had a boy named Notchy Price. He was the best bugler I've ever heard in my life. Wonderful chap. And we served together, and he was caught smoking. And he had to be punished. And that meant he had to get 6 strokes of the cane. And it had never been done, I don't think, ever, you know, not in my regiment at the time. And of course, all the boys had to go down and witness the punishment. I'm not joking. I'm not joking about this. When we came back, it wasn't very funny. And poor old Joe, I remember we got him down on the bed and rubbed his backside with Vaseline to take the strain out. But Len Livingstone, whom I listed with, he came up to me and he said, "You know, Mick, it's funny. It's not nice," he said, "but when he was getting punished, I got a hard on. I'm sorry, but this is what he said." And I said, "That's funny, so did I." And 7 of the other boys had as well. It just goes to show you what that sort of thing does to people, I think. And in fact, he said to me, only last week, Skipper and I had a little bit, and that was Joe Price, the boy. They'd been in the toilet and had a go at one another. But I was never propositioned at any time, thank God. I liked girls.
Sometimes, you know, very young men in the army can be put at a great disadvantage.
Exactly. It's quite true. Yeah. It's quite true. But first of all, and I mean this quite sincerely, I told you the lectures, and every month we were talking about venereal disease. And we knew a couple of blokes who'd been in hospital, and they had what they called hockey sticks. They weren't, but that was pushed down the pipe of their penis and scraped. And we heard, I mean, I know when I was in with my bad leg, they were in the next ward to me, and they used to scream with pain. So it put me off anyway, for thank God. I was a girl, I was a boy. I love women. I did then, and I do now, but that never appealed to me then, thank God.
Yeah.
Because it could have made things extremely awkward. It did for some of the boys. No, I mustn't say any more. I don't want to dwell on that matter, because there was one lad who got really into trouble over it.
Did he?
Yeah.
You don't need to say who he is. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Was that with an officer?
No. Now you really put me on another tack. There was one man, well known. He was the most wonderful quarter miler in the regiment, but he was a queer, Poppy. I better not mention his name, but he was Poppy. And my corporal also was called Mabel. He was also a queer, but he never, ever stepped out of line with the boys. Never, ever. He took my dog over later. But Poppy, I was sent to go to headquarters one afternoon, headquarter company office, to get an order that had been left on the desk. And when I got there, a captain and Poppy were at it. All right? I was horrified. And I was sent back by the sergeant major. And he said to me, "You never mention anything about this, MacGuff. Do you understand?" He had seen it as well. Well, honestly, for a couple of days, it was in my mind, what should I do? In the end, I kept my bloody mouth shut. But, you know, I knew it went on, and I had seen it. It never appealed to me, thank God. But I was a woman man myself, but it didn't matter. In those days, that was out, nothing to do with me then. I never, sex never entered my head till I was quite much older than that, I'm afraid. Thank God. Thank God, because I know what happened to quite a lot of the lads eventually. So we went to India.
You went to India, so you set off on ship from Singapore.
About October, it was October, I think, October, November, and I was nearly on my man service then, of course.
32. Right,
because
you went to Singapore in 31.
That's right. Yeah, early 31, and we stayed till November 32. It was almost 2 years, actually.
And whereabouts, you sailed from Singapore?
Yeah, harbour, straight to Bombay.
Bombay.
Yeah.
Right. So, what was it like coming into Bombay? Something different?
Well, first of all, we did stop at Shillong again on the way back, but that was nothing. We were still boys, we weren't on the shore. Bombay, the gateway to Bombay, it's still there, of course, as it was then. That great big, huge edifice right in the bay. And we marched around Calaba Bay Harbour, and then we trained for a place called Mhow, M-H-O-W, which naturally became quite a training school for boys from the Indian Army, many of whom I met later in later years, who schooled with my wife in India, they from the Lawrence Memorial School, and they trained at Mhow, which is quite interesting for me. But Mhow,
what sort of a place was that?
A cantonment. Nothing else. There were civilians living, Indian people, so on. But it was quite a good barracks. The boys were right on the end. There was no toilet facilities. You had to walk down 100 yards away, and you had we called them, I've forgotten the name, midnight tubs, we used to call them, because they used to be collected at midnight. But if you went there sometimes, it was awful if they hadn't cleaned them out, you know, overnight. And, but the barracks themselves were quite good, very solid. And there was, in the cantonment, there were two other batteries of Royal Artillery in different barracks from us. But the barrack square was right up on the front area, surrounded by the barracks themselves, blocks. And we were on the end, right on the end of the barrack area, the boys' room. And I only had a couple of weeks to go before I came on my man service. And Corporal Long was still with us. And I'm trying to think. The second day we were there, we saw a large procession coming up the road, Indians, and there was a body on a bier, and then they wandered right past our barrack area and then right off to the right, and over in the distance there was a tower called the Tower of Silence, Parsi burial ground. I don't know if you've heard about this before, but it was very strange. I was fortunate enough to be able to go there some other time, but the first time it was awful. We saw this, and we had seen this white, what they called a pioneer bird, flying around. And when the body was, well, we didn't know about this, but when it suddenly we saw all these vultures coming in, and they sat, we couldn't see from where we were, but it was a long way out from our barracks, but you could see the tower quite plainly, and they got all round the top. And when the people left, they just went in and ate the body. And the bones used to drop into a pit underneath. I know this because when I was on my map reading, I had the fortunate opportunity to go and see the place inside. So it was a big grating, and the body was just placed there. But that was my introduction to the Parsi whale. We saw an awful lot of these because it was the only one in Baroda. The other one was in Bombay, I think. There were only two, I think, at the time in India. So people just go a hell of a way. They were the rich people, Parsis. Very white Persian.
So this was a huge culture shock to you.
Oh yes, yeah. Yes, it was. I didn't know what was going on till I was told by the padre. That's what went on, because we asked about it. We wondered what, and it always happened. There was all we knew. A white pioneer bird would always come, and then the vultures would come in and stay around till they went on. It was horrific, really. I mean, and I wasn't very old, and it was a bit sickening to me.
And what was your padre like? He'd been with you in Singapore, had he?
And... No, we didn't have a regimental padre at the time. When I say padre, I used to go, because I couldn't go to Salvation Army in various places, I went to the Methodist Church, usually. And in Mao, I'll talk to you about this in a moment, because it was a railway centre, Mao as well, a centre. And they had a big railway institute there, which was wonderful, because our chaps used to be able to go to dances and so on. So there was a place to go. One thing I must tell you about Mao, I went to the bazaar one day, and in the bazaar they had potatoes in sacks for officers, for civilians, for troops and pigs. People won't believe me when I say, but this is true. My wife had seen the same thing in Madras, of course, but people won't believe you about this. But the Railway Institute was nice. We went there to play our dance band, and I learned to, I didn't dance ever for a long time, but I learned to dance watching people doing it, of course. And as I told you, I had to sing from a megaphone all night. There was a garage in the town, and it was run by a Mrs. Fenson, and a chap, her husband died, and another chap took it over. I only knew them because she had three daughters, Eileen, Yvonne, and Joan. My chum was going with Eileen, and I went with Yvonne for a while. Joan, they were very nice kids. They all went to the Methodist Church, that was the point. And she ran this garage with a man who'd been out there, in two of the chaps who'd been in the engineers, who'd been with her husband when he was in the army. And so, as I said, we were friendly with Eileen, and we used to pop up to their house and have a lunch sometimes on a Sunday. Very nice. After church, Christmas 35, the Methodist manse, the padre, his name was John Glanville, and his wife was Betty. Charming people. She had a small child. And they had a radio. And I remember most of our band chaps were there listening to this radio, because it was quite a thing, a radio. And King George V said his first Christmas message, and I can see the blokes now, including myself, crying. The king was talking to us. You know what I mean? It really was something. I can't get over it. I can remember it now.
Such a long way from home, too.
Pardon?
Such a long way from home.
Oh, yes.
Because you've been away from home, is that your second Christmas away from home?
Egypt, Singapore, 13th, my third Christmas.
Third Christmas away from home, yeah.
It really was something. I'm not joking. I've always been pretty loyal and royalist, but that was wonderful that day. And then I went down to the Fenson's house for a party. This is something you're not going to believe, I don't expect, but I must tell you, they had an Indian fakir there. He was very clever. He had a boy with him. And the boy was sitting very quietly, this choker kiddie, and then he told him to get a plate, and he got one from Mrs. Fenson, just an ordinary plate, and he put one grain of rice in it, yes? And we're all sitting round, a party of about 30 of us, and he started shaking this plate, and there were two grains, and then there were three grains. I'm not joking, within half an hour there was a pile of rice on this plate. Now, don't ask me how he did it, I don't know. We were literally standing right in front of him. Well, of course, it was quite... I mean, I'm only 18 now, and it really was something. Then he talked to the boy, and the chokra climbed the tree. And there he was up there in the tree. And down here he had a basket, they called it a linen basket, made of bamboo, with a lid. And he just said, "You look." We looked. There was nothing in the basket. He put the lid on, and he said some funny words, and when we looked up, the boy wasn't up there anymore. And when he took the lid off, the boy was in the basket. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, how it was done, I do not know. But it was done in front of us. There was no stage facilities or anything. So I'm just telling you, that was it. Of course, it was the talk of all the chaps who were there. Couldn't believe it, and we didn't believe it either, but it happened. So that was my first introduction to these funny Indian people.
Oh, What was the sort of integration between Indians? And,
pardon?
What was the integration between Indians and not
much.
Britishers?
Well, can I put it this way? We were not allowed to talk to Indian folk. There was a real distinction between whites in those days. Don't get me wrong. There were nice Indians who we were, you know, but the normal villager you didn't talk to.
Right.
It wasn't allowed anyway. Mm. One afternoon, I was lying on my bed after a game of football. That's another thing. It was too hot to drill, but you could go and play sport, you know what I mean. And we always had afternoons off. Very often we went on a dog and stick. You'd take your dog and go for a walk with the regiment. But this particular day, suddenly I thought, that's funny. I felt a tremor and I looked up and our equipment that should have been against the wall like that was hanging out like that, yes? It wasn't the equipment that was hanging out. The building had moved. The earthquake at Quetta.
Oh, right.
Yes? We were miles from Quetta. But everybody was scared. It went back. All the things went back to the wall. My chum John said, did you see that, Mick? And I said, yes, I did. And we were frightened and we went out. Within an hour on the Maidan, which was huge in front of our barracks, or the rear of our barracks, really, a plane came in and told us there had been an earthquake at Quetta. The sad thing about it was that John and Betty Glanville and their little baby were being sent to Quetta and they got killed in the earthquake. That was my first very big disappointment out there. Padre was
did
gone.
Did the Gloucesters do anything?
No, we were too far away to do anything, but I do know that stuff was sent up, and I think A Company used to load planes to take, because the land, it wasn't a landing strip, but the Maidan was so big it was used as a landing strip. That was the only time, I think, and only twice more we ever saw a plane come into our place.
Yeah.
But it was quite a bad time, actually.
So what was daily life like there? I mean, you were still being a bandsman. I mean,
yes.
You were practising music.
Yeah.
And there was no drilling in the hot season?
Oh, yes, you drilled all the time.
Right.
Oh, you drilled all the time. In fact, it was only just then, about the time that I went to the regiment, that they stopped wearing spine pads. You know, in the hot places, they used to wear a spine pad because quite a lot of blokes, we had seen it get knocked on the neck and do a tumble, you know, get heat stroke. Oh, well, they didn't call it that. Dulaney tap, we used to call it. It didn't happen very often. But until I went to India, they were issued with spine pads and they stopped it. And our topis were different too, by the way.
So daily life for you there in Mao?
Regimental,
yeah.
Duties. A band practice, parades, RSM's parade, adjutant's parade, CO's parade, church parade. Very often the brigadier would have a parade on the big place with the artillery and all the rest of it. Funerals were quite upsetting. You always had to, and I was in the band then, and the band always had to play the Dead March in Seoul and so on. It wasn't very funny. In fact, we had some tragic times. One lad fell under a horse, but anyway, you know,
how did he fall under a horse? Was this?
He was on, you know, 6-1 with a gun carriage on, and one bucked and he fell off, and the gun carriage went over him. It was a terrible. Could they got buried the same day? You understand me? I remember quite a few funerals there. It wasn't very much funny.
Was there a lot of sickness because you were in a very hot climate?
No, we weren't.
You were quite healthy.
We didn't get many jabs in those days either, not like we did later on. When we went to Burma, there was quite an awful lot of anti-tetanus and TAB and so on. My book upstairs would tell you. But we didn't get too many jabs. It was only if there was something on, if there was a sort of epidemic amongst the natives, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think Mao was quite a good little station for us. Mm-hmm. It was on a plateau. It wasn't too hot, but it was hot enough, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I now was able to box for my unit because I was a man.
You were 18 now.
I was a middleweight boxer.
Right. So when you became 18, did you transfer from the boys band to the...
No, you were already in the band, you understand me.
Right.
All we did was transfer from the boys' room to the men's room.
Right, so you physically moved your bed.
That's right, yeah, that was it. You took all your kit and moved upstairs.
How did that feel? That must have been quite
not much,
day.
Not okay, much, no. Because we had nothing different from the men. We had a box in front of our bed that you had to polish highly with all your personal stuff in, and a locker on which was your shirts and your kit, your khaki kit, and so on. And quite honestly, Tom Latimer, who I'll talk about later, he became a sergeant. He's still in Chelsea now. But Tom Latimer was one of these clever clogs. And instead of putting he put a piece of shirt and a piece of this and a piece of that on a piece of cardboard. And, of course, it used to look exactly just it should be, 9 inches, because the bayonet, it had to be a bayonet blaze length, 9 inches. And Tom Latimer had this up, and it was all over the back. Pictures were taken. This is how your kit must be laid. And one morning, Colonel Chapman came in, and the wind blew, and the drawer went, and the ruddy lot fell out. Tom got 12 days jankers. I've always remembered it. But the colonel was tickled about it, but he had to be punished, because he had no kit. Oh, isn't it funny when you... I've forgotten that bit. Yeah. But
what about the daily housekeeping, as it was? You had people came and took your laundry away.
Yes, Adobe. You had Adobe, which we paid a very nominal sum for, by the way. It was practically chicken feed. It was not, the boys didn't pay, actually. The kit was done by the Adobe. In the morning...